serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This hour, we'll be hearing excerpts from the Intelligence Squared U.S. debate that took place at Asia Society in New York City on the evening of October 30th, 2007. This series of debates is sponsored by the Rosenkranz Foundation, and the proposition this time is Russia is becoming our enemy again. The audience was polled before and after the event, and we'll have the final results later in the program, but the entry poll gauged the live audience as 41% in favor of the motion, and only 23% against. 36% were undecided. The moderator for the night was a veteran Russia and Eastern Europe observer, Edward Lucas of The Economist. There are three panelists on each side, and each gives an opening statement, and we'll sample some of these statements, starting with Claudia Rosette. She's a journalist in residence at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Unfortunately, it is not. I am here tonight to argue for the motion that Russia is becoming our enemy again. Russia is an enormous polity encompassing more than 140 million people, 11 time zones, and a multitude of views. I'm sure that many people in this room are personally acquainted with Russians who are by no means our enemies. But inside Russia, their views count for less and less. And in speaking of Russia in this debate tonight, we must speak of the increasingly authoritarian Russian state of President Putin, of the security apparatus, and the chief and increasingly centralized and authoritarian centers of power. No one is here tonight to argue that Russia is right now our enemy. The motion up for debate is that Russia is becoming our enemy again. It is that direction, that becoming, that trajectory which we are here to debate. For two benchmarks, I would like to share with you a memory of a dinner in Moscow more than a decade ago. It was with someone who has experienced then and since firsthand Russia's trajectory, not at a distance, but has been living it. He was then optimistic. It was a dinner with a number of journalists, and despite our worries, he assured us that all would be well, that Russia was heading in a good direction, that Russians could get rich doing honest business. His name was Garry Kasparov. Today, Mr. Kasparov has been pouring forth articles and giving interviews in the West, warning us that Russia is becoming, indeed has become, a criminal petrostate. The model, he tells us, is not the old czarist autocracy, but the godfather, the mafia. He wants to run in the presidential election next March, but what he recently told MSNBC is that, quote, we're not fighting to win elections, we're fighting to have elections. For the radio audience, I've just placed a teapot and a teacup on the lectern. And I'd like to just invite you for a minute to engage in a little imaginary experiment, that you are a Russian Democrat, a patriot, trying to warn the free world that Russia is becoming an increasingly dangerous police state. Let's say you're investigating the murder of a journalist and you meet in a city, say London, with an emissary of the Kremlin. You have every right to the question you wish to ask. Tea is served. Would you, without a second thought these days, drink that tea? This is a picture of Alexander Litvinenko, who drank it. He's here on his deathbed. These are the effects of polonium-210 on the human body. The Kremlin denies anything to do with it. This is a picture of Viktor Yushchenko during his successful bid for the presidency of the Ukraine over the Kremlin's objections. These are the effects of dioxin on the human face. The Kremlin denies anything to do with it. The broad arc is that in the early 1990s, everything was up for grabs. The rules, the property, the whole thing, it was being sorted out. At this point, the shakeout has largely taken place. What do we see? The government has effectively reabsorbed the revenues coming from such oil and gas giants as Yukos and Gazprom. We've seen the murdering of journalists. We've seen the targeting of businessman Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who wanted to engage on Western terms with Western business. We've seen the rising charade of elections with President Putin now suggesting he might want to stay on as prime minister. Does this make Russia our enemy? Yes, that's, and the reason why is governments such as this need enemies to justify what they do, to deflect anger and frustrations, to show that they are important and necessary. In Russia's quest to do that, the real rival is the U.S. And following
that was Claudia Rosette. Next, we'll hear from Robert Legvold, the Marshall D. Shulman Professor in the Department of Political Science at Columbia University. He is arguing against the motion that Russia is becoming our enemy again.
It's a pleasure to be with you and a pleasure to be a part of this event. I think everybody in this hall would agree that Russia today is not a U.S. ally, not even a disaffected ally, as so many of our traditional friends are. But then to claim that Russia is, or soon will be, an enemy seems to us to be both wrong and unhelpful, almost certainly even harmful. It's wrong because it misunderstands what Russia's all about, and it misunderstands what motivates its foreign policy today. And it's unhelpful, maybe even harmful, as I've said, because it almost certainly runs the risk of bringing about the behavior and the stance on Russia's part that we fear in the first place, and not the least by driving home or reinforcing the extraordinary excessive suspicion of U.S. that radiates across not merely the political leadership but the political spectrum in Russia, and the enormously warped misinterpretation of U.S. Foreign policy and what we are all about. There's no question that Putin himself has put Russia in the forefront of the most vocal critics of U.S. foreign policy. There's no question that anti-Americanism within Russia is more intense and more widespread, not only than it has been at any point in the 15 years of Russian independence, but well back into the Soviet period. There's no question that what Russia is doing on a number of issues of concern to us is contrary to our preferences. And there is no question, as Claudia has well demonstrated, that under Putin, Russia has veered from the democratic path. That makes Russia a challenge. That doesn't make Russia an enemy. What is Russia about? I think three things. First of all, a renewed voice. Russia, again, wants a place at the table with the major powers. Secondly, Russia wants respect for its national interests as it defines them, not the way in which we define them. And Russia wants an independent role in international politics, even a leadership role. And we're seeing it increasingly in the way in which they exert themselves as a mediator on major issues among and between major powers. What makes Russia a challenge and not an enemy? I think it is the ambiguity and the shapelessness at the very base of Russian foreign policy today, because the heart of Russia's international posture today is a unity of opposites. Russia claims it has no enemy, it has no ally. No one is an enemy, no one is an ally, everyone is a partner, everyone is a competitor. And that leads to a behavior which is troublesome not only for us, but I think for the future of Russia and its foreign policy. Russian foreign policy is driven by impulses and desires, but impulses are not a strategy, and even less are they a strategic vision. And without strategic vision, Russia is not in a position to make durable, long-term strategic choices. So then, what should be our response in these circumstances? First of all, what not to do? What not to do is premature containment and jumping to that conclusion. Not empty hectoring, not drawing red lines, not even tough love, particularly when we have so little direct leverage in order to pursue that kind of a policy. And what to do? A policy that would be deft, that would be coherent, that would be frank, and that would be firm, and that would follow...
That was Robert Legvold. Here's Brett Stevens, who writes the Global View column in the Wall Street Journal. He used his opening statement to lay out a month-by-month timeline of events from the past year that illustrate how he believes Russia is becoming our enemy again. We'll hear some excerpts, and when he mentions the FSB, that's a government agency in Russia known as the Federal Security Service, it's the successor to the KGB.
Just the past year. Let me remind you that we are on the eve of the anniversary of the poisoning of Alexander Litvinenko. Let me remind you also that Alexander Litvinenko was a British subject. He was murdered by a lethal dose of polonium-210, which was a de facto case of nuclear homicide, if not nuclear terrorism. From his deathbed, Litvinenko personally accused Vladimir Putin of ordering the assassination. Since then, Scotland Yard has pinned the murder on a Russian businessman, an ex, or if you will, current FSB man named Andrei Lugovoy. In a month's time, Mr. Lugovoy, Litvinenko's killer, is likely to be elected a member of the Russian parliament. In December of 2006, the Kremlin pulled the rug out from the largest foreign investment to date in Russia, which was Shell's $20 billion oil and gas project on Sakhalin Island, using transparently phony regulatory excuses. It happened again in June to British Petroleum. The assault on foreign investment in Russia was the natural extension of the illegal seizure of Russia's privately held energy assets, particularly those of Yukos and its CEO, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, whose prison term in a Siberian labor camp has recently been extended. In February, a man named Ivan Safronov, a reporter for the Kommersant newspaper, fell from a fourth-story window onto the street, where he died instantly. The authorities ruled it a suicide, but most observers believe that Safronov, who had repeatedly embarrassed the Russian military with his reporting, was executed, making him the 14th such journalist killed, murdered, during Mr. Putin's reign. The same month, a Russian court condemned 9 members of the ethnic minorities rights group FRODA for having a quote-unquote unsanctioned tea with 2 German students. Quote, "We were told that under the new law on NGOs, any meeting of 2 or more people with a purpose of discussing publicly important issues has to be sanctioned by the local administration 3 days in advance," FRODA's director told London's Daily Telegraph. The next month, in March, an American Russia analyst named Paul Joyle was shot outside his home in suburban Maryland shortly after meeting a former KGB general. 4 days before that shooting, on Dateline NBC, Mr. Joyle had noted that, quote, "A message has been communicated to anyone who wants to speak out against the Kremlin. If you do, no matter where you are, we will find you and we will silence you in the most horrible way possible," end of quote. The next month, in April, Mr. Putin indicated that he intended to withdraw Russia from the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, one of the landmark agreements ending the Cold War. He has since indicated that he is prepared to withdraw Russia from the 1987 Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty signed by Reagan and Gorbachev. And finally, I would like to make one point. Just last week, George W. Bush insisted in a speech that Russia is not an enemy of the United States. Now, if that does not convince this audience that our side is right, I don't know what will. Thank you very much.
That was Bret Stephens. And these are excerpts from a live Intelligence Squared debate. You can listen to the event in its entirety at our website, npr.org/intelligencesquared. We'll be back with more of the opening statements, followed by the discussion period, in just 1 minute. You're listening to an Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, and we'll now continue to sample the opening statements with Nina Khrushcheva. She's a senior fellow of the World Policy Institute and the great-granddaughter of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. She's arguing against the motion, Russia is becoming our enemy again.
And he does. The United States grumble about Putin's international policy, but loudly talks about his internal policy. But actually, disagreements on how to run a state is not enough to make an enemy. Just look at Saudi Arabia. While in foreign policy, the discussion actually does take place. Here I would like to quote quite commonsensical Condoleezza Rice during the talks on the U.S. missile defense plan in Eastern Europe. And I quote, "Even though we have our differences, we have a great deal in common because that which unites us in trying to deal with threats of terrorism, of proliferation, is much greater than the issues that divide us." She said it in Moscow on October 12th this year. Moreover, even Dick Cheney, who came out of the Dr. Strangelove Cold War generation, and thus sees enemies everywhere. In 2006 Vilnius presentation, despite his tough talk on Putin's backtracking on democracy, said, and I quote, "None of us believes that Russia is fated to become an enemy." So it's not just George Bush. There are smarter people who said that. Putin would argue that both Russia and the United States today are of the same ideology, that is democracy, and of the same economic system, which is capitalism. In essence, he feels they disagree on tactics, methodology, and implementation. In conclusion, U.S.-Russian relations today certainly display annoyance and some genetic Cold War-rooted suspicions. So the language of the Cold War creeps in and is read as animosity. But there is a serious recognition that there is plenty of common interest in the oil and energy strategy, talks with Iran and North Korea, and many others. Let's face it.
That was Nina Khrushcheva. Now, here's J. Michael Waller. He holds the Walter and Leonore Annenberg Chair in International Communication at the Institute of World Politics. He is the final speaker for the motion.
Across the country. At the same time, there was no accountability or national reconciliation. So if you look at where there was a de-Stasification campaign in East Germany against the Stasi, there was nothing of the sort in Russia. So no one has been exposed or held accountable for any of the crimes of the past. And as a result of that lack of accountability and lack of national introspection, it's become normal among most Russians to be treated as they had been. And imagine having a free West Germany without denazification, and allowing former Gestapo people to stay in their posts and even become president of the country. It's the moral equivalent there. At the same time, this summer, the Russian government came out with an ideological guidelines for social studies and history for public schools in Russia. And it's a Kremlin-imposed guideline. Putin himself addressed the teachers and the academics at the book launch. He said, "We must not allow others to impose a feeling of guilt on us." And the Washington Post coverage of this event, they surveyed the social studies guy. They said it's, quote, "marked by intense hostility to the United States." And the editor of the manual, Leonid Polyakov, said, "We are developing a national ideology that represents the vision of ourselves as a nation, as Russians, a vision of our own identity and the world around us, a paranoid, hostile, enemy-oriented identity." And the last chapter of the history guidebook lays out a new cult of personality of the new Russian president. Quote, "We see that practically every significant deed is connected with Vladimir V. Putin." So this cult of personality is being built. They require some foreign adversary to justify the repressive measures they take. Now, the iconography of the old KGB has been preserved. Imagine if after denazification in West Germany, the old symbols were still preserved of the Nazi Party. Yet if you go to the Russian police stations, they have the sword and shield. That's the old Bolshevik Cheka secret police symbol. You go to the Foreign Intelligence Service offices, you go to the FSB state security services, you go to the state prosecutor, they have the same symbol. This is the type of system that Russia's preserving. You have an out-of-control spy services where corruption, contract killings, bombings, since Putin has been first state security chief and then prime minister and then president, the Russian military intelligence, which feeds on paranoia the same way it did in the Soviet times, that organization has not been reformed at all. Yet that continues to feed on paranoia in its intelligence reporting to the Russian military and political leadership, that the West is still a great threat. Military reform has not occurred. In fact, the military is modernizing. They have an intercontinental ballistic missile force, brand new modern force, the Topol-M. They don't need it. We're not their enemy. They don't need it. Right now, as we're speaking, the Yuri Dolgoruki, which is the new Bore-class nuclear submarine, is undergoing its sea trials now. New ballistic missile submarine, more modern than anything we have. They don't need it. This is not a sign of a country that's seeking to be an ally of the West, and every sign that the intent is in the future to have the capability to be our enemy if the political climate so declares. Thank you.
That was Michael Waller. Now, here's the final opening statement on the proposition Russia is becoming our enemy again. It's from Mark Medish, who oversees the Russia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Mark Medish.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming this evening, particularly if you're voting against the motion. I urge you to reject the motion, ladies and gentlemen. To reject it is not at all to defend Russia or to defend Mr. Putin. It is to be clear about U.S. interests and about realistic U.S. policy options. Indeed, the motion is wrong for at least three main reasons, in my view. First, it gets Russia wrong from the standpoint of U.S. national security interests. Where we find interests in common with other countries, we must work together with them as best we can. There may be deep disappointments, and indeed there is great disillusionment and disenchantment in the mutual relationship today, on both sides. Nevertheless, that doesn't change our core national security interests in containing weapons of mass destruction, in limiting the proliferation of fissile materials, in strategic arms control, in stability throughout Eurasia and in the Middle East, and in countering Islamic extremism. These are core issues. They have not changed recently for us or for the Russians. We need to do a better job working together to address these interests. The second reason that the motion is wrong is that it lacks historical perspective and is incorrect on its face. Russia is not the Soviet Union. The motion conflates the two. Russia could not be becoming our enemy again. This Russia has never been our enemy. So there is no again at play here. And I urge you to take the words seriously. The words do matter when we vote on a motion. We don't have a new Cold War coming. It may be a cool peace, but that's a very important distinction. It's disagreeable, it's suboptimal, it's difficult, but it's not a war. It's a heightened challenge. Finally, I want to talk about the mindset, the friend-foe problem, because it really represents a mentality that is most likely to lead us down the wrong path. We need to pay careful attention to distinctions and details in assessing the trend lines, lest the friend-foe distinctions become a self-fulfilling prophecy. It simply need not be so. Regrettably, there are people in Russia who think the same way. If we were in Moscow today, I'd be debating against them, reminding them that the U.S. is not their enemy and is not becoming their enemy. There's a vast middle distance. Lots of difficult, complicated countries. China, Pakistan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia. All countries where we could have a long discussion about the litany of problems, as we've just heard about Russia. It doesn't make them our enemy. It doesn't mean that they're becoming our enemy. They are counterparts.
That was Mark Medish. And now we'll begin the discussion section of the debate with the evening's moderator, the economist's Edward Lucas.
Discussion going here. And I'd like, first of all, to ask Brett Stevens to come back on the point that Robert Legvold made about how this is just Russia wanting to be heard. This is Russia is no longer on its knees as an economically successful country with a popular president, with its own view of how things should be in the world, and feeling that it really has the right to make itself heard and to have that that view taken seriously. So, Brett Stevens, don't you think there's something in that?
All countries have the right to make themselves heard. The French make themselves heard very, very vocally and often very effectively. The same goes, it's an ordinary fact of international political life. But if you are, say, the president of a struggling young democracy called Georgia, and it is the middle of winter, and you find that there have been two simultaneous pipeline explosions that are piping in gasoline supplies to your country on Christmas Eve, that is a very different way of making yourself heard. The same happens, of course, if you are Viktor Yushchenko and you are campaigning for the presidency of an independent country called Ukraine, which nonetheless Vladimir Putin and his friends in the Ukraine still consider a satrap of the of Russia, or excuse me, what they wish still was the Soviet Union. And so the way you go about dealing with Mr. Yushchenko is by administering a nearly lethal dose of dioxin. That is a very different way of making yourself heard. And it is our contention on this side. We are not interested in making Russia another enemy. We wish, with all respect to the psychoanalysis on the other side, as Mark rightly pointed out, we ought to have common interests. We really do have a common enemy in Islamic extremism, but facts are facts. And when Russia, or rather this Russian government, makes itself heard, it makes itself heard by bullying, by violence and by intimidation.
Robert Legvo, do you think that answered your point, that this is not just Russia making itself heard, it's breaking the rules and doing things in an extreme and damaging way that disrupts the neighborhood, and that must be something the United States has to try and counter?
I think that's right. As the argument I'm making is not that Russian behavior is admirable in all respects and doesn't pose a problem, but I am saying that the major motivation for doing this kind of thing is as I described it, and often I think we overlook that dimension of it. My problem with the argument that's being made by the other side right now is the risk of oversimplification. The monochromatic picture that's being presented, which in its characterization of Russia carries a very high risk of generating a self-fulfilling prophecy in the first instance, and secondly, that is almost certainly going to be, would recommend behavior on our part that will be contrary to our national interest because of the stakes we have in being able to cooperate with Russia if we can move in that direction, even in terms of moving Russia domestically. One of the questions that we need to ask the other side in the course of the evening, what do they want to do about it? And what they want to do about it will begin telling you what the risks are of acting on their characterization of Russia as they present it, which is vastly oversimplified. There's nobody in this room that wants to, as Marx said, defend what's happening in Russia. Not only is it disturbing to us, there are a number of things that have happened that are utterly reprehensible, but it's not only a black and white story. I was witness to a conversation between Steve Hadley, who is our national security advisor, and the principal advisor to President Bush, and Vladimir Lukin, who is the ombudsman for human rights in the Soviet Union, a position that's appointed by the Duma. Hadley's point was that we wish well, we believe that democracy and building democracy is very important in Russia, and as a part of that, a free press is crucial, and we are very disturbed over the murder of Anna Politkovskaya. And it was clear that Hadley wanted a message carried back to Moscow on this story. Lukin's response was very measured and very careful. He said, we are deeply concerned about it as well in the ombudsman's office. As I said, this is an official. He's appointed by the Duma. He said that there is an investigation underway. He said, we're concerned because not only Anna Stepanova, but also two other editors from Novaya Gazeta, her newspaper, have been destroyed along the way. The investigation is very important to us. And he said the important thing is that at this stage, the editors of Novaya Gazeta, which is one of the more open and critical newspapers, are satisfied with the way in which this process is proceeding. And then he finished by saying that each year, the Ombudsman's Office for Human Rights makes four awards for advancing human rights in Russia. And this year, the Ombudsman's Office made that award to Anna Stepanova and to Novaya Gazeta. Now, that's not to deny all the other things that are very true. Crackdown on the NGOs, the closing down, particularly of the electronic media, maybe even the suspicion that officials at a senior level were involved with the murder of Litvinenko. But that's still not a proven point. I mean, right. Lugovoy may be the murderer, but we don't know that it traces directly to Putin. There are a series of these accusations that are being made tonight that are simply too monochromatic.
Well, Robert Legvo, let me just take, you made a very interesting point. What would the other side like to do about it? Let me put that to Claudia Rosette. Okay, imagine you were Secretary of State or National Security Advisor in some future administration. What would you be, or even President, what policy would you be advocating? What should we be doing?
Well, with due respect, I think the motion tonight is not what we should do about the fact that Russia is becoming our enemy again, but is it becoming our enemy again? And so I'm actually not going to suggest a policy in reaction tonight, but I would like to just mention that from the opposing side, and I wish they were right, but I urge you to look at what we are presenting and vote that they are not. We've heard about, and I'm quoting here, the cool piece, the challenge, the heightened challenge, and we've also heard the Saudis described as a good example of a country that with which we may have disagreements, but they are not our enemy. That might be a good subject for a future debate. And I would suggest that what we're actually listening to here is the difficulty of figuring out what to do about the fact that, yes, indeed, Russia is becoming our enemy again.
But I think it's time to take a question from the audience. So I'm going to go for the right-hand aisle, Mr. Barry Wade. So please, sir, state your question.
As I understand some remarks that Garry Kasparov has made recently on his book tour in the United States, he charges Putin with essentially devoting his administration to the support of oil prices and creating turmoil throughout the world for the specific purpose of increasing oil prices, essentially so that he and his friends can pocket the money, that it's really about the money, it's not about geopolitics. My question is Kasparov correct? And if so, what does that say about tonight's proposition?
That's an excellent question. I'm going to give it first of all to Nina Khrushcheva. What do you think about Garry Kasparov's analysis of what's happening?
Well, Garry Kasparov is speaking and very popular in the West. He is very much called for. His opinions are called for. Not so much in Russia. And in fact, I must say that for a lot of Russian observers, in fact, Garry Kasparov often becomes a nuisance because he also simplifies the real problem that Russia faces and takes away attention from detailed policies that could be presented and designed. As for this assumption, I have to say I sort of agree with him that Putin's Russia is quite a bit about money. I mean, Mikhail Khodorkovsky's story, as the Russian saying goes, they broke the Yukos company just to give Putin the dower for his daughters. It's oversimplification probably, but the money certainly is a huge, huge part of the Putin story. However, it's not exactly part of that. Putin also tries to establish the Russian ideology, reestablish the greatness of the Russian state, and I think that he's very much preoccupied with. And he believes that the state needs money to do that. So I'm not quite sure that Kasparov's assumption that it all goes to him personally is quite correct. I think they do put it to work into sort of creating the state's strength. So in discussing Russia, we need not to look at black and white and simplification, but really see what kind of real policies are happening and exactly what's behind those decisions and policies.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, thank
you. That was Nina Khrushcheva arguing against the motion, Russia is becoming our enemy again. We'll hear more of the discussion period, followed by closing statements and the results of the audience poll in just 1 minute. I'm Robert Siegel, and this is Intelligence Squared U.S. We'll now rejoin the discussion period of the debate, right where we left off. Here's moderator Edward Lucas posing a question to Michael Waller, a speaker for the motion.
Then to Michael Waller, you've written extensively about corruption at the highest levels in Russia, and if it really is just a front for corruption, all this xenophobic and imperialist rhetoric, then isn't, in a way, that doesn't that make it impossible for Russia to be our enemy because they're only really interested in self-enrichment? We can buy them off.
Well, with oil prices, it's kind of hard to find a better way to buy them. We certainly don't have any influence with them, with our loans anymore, with the IMF. In fact, it was Boris Fyodorov, the early finance minister in the democratic Russian government, who warned us that don't loan us $1 billion from the IMF because that's not enough to help us and it's too much to fuel corruption. But when you look at Putin's background, where he was in St. Petersburg as the KGB guy handling foreign currency transactions, hard currency transactions with no checks and balances, his qualifications were that he was a liaison officer to the East German Stasi for several years. In fact, that was his nickname in St. Petersburg, Stasi. So Stasi comes to Moscow to run the Presidential Property Administration, the notoriously honest Boris Yeltsin administration's property management system, where his daughter also had great economic interests at stake. So here he's the money mover, he's the money hider, he's the one with the KGB networks to make sure everything can be done quietly and efficiently. But at the same time, he's a patriot. He does love his country. And you can have crooked patriots. And so he's using oil revenues and gas revenues to finance a huge military modernization program, using that currency for that, for infrastructure development, and for other things that will ensure that he and his people are kept in power. They cannot leave power, because if they do leave power, they'll be arrested or worse because of the crimes they've committed. So you have sort of a Mobutu-type system here, only Russian-style, where you have a much more efficient administration than Mobutu ever had. But unlike Mobutu, Putin's not looting everything. He's leaving a lot for the Russian public, for the pension system, and for others, so that he gets a permanent support base probably for the rest of his life.
Edward, let me go ahead, respond
come,
to something.
Robert Legville, do come back on that.
Respond to what Michael's just been saying. One of the phrases he uses, this enormous military modernization within Russia. Do you know what the Russian military budget is this year? It's $31 billion. You know what our military budget is? $430 billion. Our military budget is half of GDP of Russia at this point. Secondly, he talked about the modernization of strategic forces, including this nuclear submarine, which is behind schedule. It's only one. And serious analysts on the Russian side that know this and are very critical of Russian foreign policy and the Putin regime are very concerned about a different kind of a problem. Because if we really do move in this direction where we are adversaries and we do begin again engaging the nuclear contest, then somewhere around 2015, Russia, because of the attrition of its forces, its weakening of its strategic forces, will be forced to what is called a launch on warning policy, which is very destabilizing. It's the part of the world that we've forgotten about as we concentrate on these other problems. And addressing that, we have to deal with the Russians. We are together still 90% of the nuclear weapons in the world when we talk about the nuclear haves. We need the Russians, not just in energy, not just in dealing with issues of regional instability and nuclear nonproliferation, but indeed of working this problem of stability within the Eurasian heartland. What they're talking about in terms of the tension in Russia's relations with Georgia or the things that the Russians are doing with Ukraine, they're quite right. That really is a threat. We need to work that problem. How are we going to work the problem? Right. Claudia says we don't have to talk about what the implications are of this. I'm saying everything matters, because the way you phrase this problem is not cost-free.
Let me just come straight back to Michael Waller. The Russian military is very weak, and we'd be safer if they had more nukes.
That's sort of, yeah. Well, and they're spending their money in the nuclear weapons program with the Topol-M, SS-27, ICBM. They boast that it can break through our missile defense systems, yet they complain about how dangerous our missile defense system is. It doesn't matter whether their submarine has had problems or it's over schedule. They've laid the keels for two more of them, and the current one is at sea trials now, and it is a very advanced piece of equipment, and it's a revolutionary design, so it's going to have problems. The projected military budget is to build a new strategic long-range nuclear bomber and long-range nuclear cruise missiles to go aboard those bombers. We can't pretend these things away. This shows intent of the Russian political and military leadership, and it's something that we're going to have to grapple with. We can't call them friends for behaving this way.
Right, well, let's, on the subject of missiles, there's an excellent question from the audience, last row, left side, Marvin D. Resnick. If you'd like to identify yourself, please give us your question.
When we had detente, and the Russians withdrew militarily, we kept our missiles in Europe to be directed at the Middle East, supposedly. And I'm wondering if that didn't turn Putin into a cynic who said, well, I can't trust the United States if they're going to keep their missiles there. And that set him off on a, shall I say, a right-wing course.
Right. Well, I think it's very interesting in this context to look at the American missile defense bases in which are planned for Poland and the Czech Republic and have been very controversial there. So let's wrap that together. Let me put that to Claudia Rosette, do you think that how justified is Putin in seeing after NATO expansion, when Russia was promised that there would be no big NATO bases in the former Warsaw Pact countries, and now here we are building two quite important ones. Aren't the Russians justified in feeling a little bit antsy about this, a little bit paranoid?
I think that from the Russian point of view, if anything, it's one more convenient excuse. I mean, could we back up here for a minute? When the Russian government came in, building on the debris of the Soviet Union, and in many ways it is the same Russia, they had an enormous challenge ahead where the great hope was that they would build a genuine democratic state, and that required great concentration on internal reforms. And more, what we've been listening to is a focus on external enemies, on ways of avoiding that kind of actually dealing inside. So should he be concerned? We're not about to attack Russia. And I don't think that we're arguing here this evening that Russia is about to physically attack the United States. What we're worried about is that they are becoming increasingly antagonistic to our interests. And could I just suggest that this is not only military? On the diplomatic front, if you follow the United Nations, Russia is over and over again at loggerheads with everything that is in the U.S. interests, both in the debate that's gone on in Iran, in the effort to enforce sanctions on Iraq, they were the number one cheaters, and in the votes at the U.N., they line up with Iran, with Cuba, with Syria, with countries that are very much opposed to the U.S. interests. It's that kind of, that trend
right.
that we're talking about tonight.
Mark Medish, against the motion. Do you want to come back on that?
I would. I'd like to go back to the gist of the question because I think it really brings up an important point that again, if we were sitting in Moscow, we would hear from people there a long bill of particulars about how they feel that Russia has been slighted in the post-Cold War period, how the U.S. advanced its interests in an unconsultative manner against Russia's interests. And you named one area of the forward basing of missiles, the NATO enlargement, which the U.S. had actually promised to rule out during the process of German reunification, but that went forward. I think it's good that it did, but it irritated the Russians. The unilateral abrogation of the ABM treaty by the Bush administration in its first months in office, that angered the Russians. It annoyed them, the unilateralism of it in particular. So there's a long list on that side as well. We have a list. We need to cut through this because these bills of particulars don't actually add up to a hostile enemy relationship. We need to bear in mind in America that other countries are allowed to have national security interests as well. And they won't always line up perfectly. There will be friction. I think what Secretary Rice and Secretary Gates did in Moscow a couple of weeks ago was actually quite productive. They went there and they listened to the Russian views as to how this project could perhaps be done better in a cooperative manner. And I think they've made some progress in that regard. And so I commend the Bush administration for opening its ears and trying to avoid the self-fulfilling prophecy of believing the rhetoric. And by gosh, there's a lot of rhetoric out there.
Well, let me just follow up on that with another question to the people opposing the motion. There's, I think, a consensus here that the mood in Russia is quite anti-Western, and a lot of the propaganda or stance taken by the media in Russia stokes this up. We heard about textbooks that's in the media as well. I'd like to ask Nina Khrushcheva, who's speaking against the motion, isn't there a danger that people actually start believing this, even if it doesn't take effect right now and the Kremlin is still dealable with? Surely only a matter of time before that propaganda starts taking effect, they'll get what they've wished for.
Absolutely. There is always a danger with propaganda. It could be successful or unsuccessful, and Putin's propaganda is incredibly successful because, as you know, not only that he has tough stance on America sometimes, on international debate, but he also walks around half-naked in Siberia showing off his abs. I mean, and this is the most successful propaganda you can have. All of a sudden, Russia has a president that is better than James Bond. I mean, that is a very powerful message. And in fact, I think this message is also created because the military exercises, threatening as they may look, in fact, they're not really going that well. So there is a certain danger that it could happen. But, you know, I'm the only Russian here, so I can speak from experience. Russians are only gullible to a certain extent. And when the minute it stops happening, I can assure you, dissidentship will come back as it was in the 50s and 60s, or what we've never seen before.
Thanks very much, Nina Khrushchev. Very briefly, Brett Stevens, do you want to come back on that?
On a couple of points. First of all, to Nina's point, incompetence is not intention. If the Russians are building brand new nuclear missile submarines, the fact that they're not building them well or the sea trials aren't going well doesn't address the basic point, which is that this is what they intend to do. So that's a point that needs to be made. I want to get back to something that Mark said as well. First of all, I'm delighted that we have found finally a bipartisan moment where a former Clinton administration official is handsomely praising the diplomacy of the successors, and I find this one of the ironies of this conversation. What Mark said comes from a kind of school that this is all a big misunderstanding we have with the Russians. They have one view of the world. We have a different view of the world. We need a kind of therapy session to work through these kinds of misunderstandings. And while that is true in some ways, I don't think it can really account either for Russian behavior or the efforts by two, if not three, American administrations to bend over backwards and make excuses for the Putin government. In fact, one of the great complaints I hear when Russian, usually dissident figures, come through our offices at the Wall Street Journal, they will say, why is your president constantly forgiving, acquiescing, making excuses for Vladimir Putin? There's one other point I'd like to make, which is, yes, the United States and Russia ought to have common interests, and yet, strangely, the Russians seem to work at cross-purposes with what we would say at this table are their basic interests. Why are they building a nuclear reactor at Bushehr, which Mr. Putin just said he is ready to complete, which in a period of about 15 months will create 330 kilograms of spent fuel, which can easily be reprocessed into about 50 to 60 Nagasaki-type bombs? Is that the Russian interest?
That was Brett Stevens of the Wall Street Journal concluding our discussion period. In our remaining time, we'll listen to excerpts from just a few of the closing statements, beginning with Mark Medish. He's arguing against the motion, Russia is becoming our enemy again.
There's no irony in my praise for the work of the present administration. I come from a strong bipartisan tradition in U.S. foreign policy, and I wish the Wall Street Journal editorial board would rediscover that part of the American heritage. On Iran policy, I just wanted to mention that Russia and Israel have both reaffirmed many times that they view each other as strategic allies. After Putin's visit to Tehran recently, he met with Ehud Olmert in Moscow, and the same statements and reassurances were made. And that gives me confidence that the Russians are not beyond the pale on this issue, but may in fact be part of the solution ultimately. It's a very difficult problem. Once again, I urge you to reject this motion. Rejecting it is not to defend Russia, and it's not to defend Mr. Putin's track record. The motion should be rejected because of core U.S. national security interests. This is a question about core interests, not about metaphors or metaphysics. The proposition is wrong on its face. Russia could not be our enemy again. This Russia has never been our enemy. We also should avoid Manichaeanism in our foreign policy. We have enough real enemies. Let's not imagine new ones. Like China, Russia is a very difficult counterpart and partner. It's not our enemy. Russia may be its own worst enemy, but that does not mean it's becoming ours. I urge you to reject the motion. Thank you.
Mark Medish, thank you very much. And finally, Michael Waller.
Thank you. Not even Al-Qaeda is building a nuclear missile system that can wipe out our entire country. And we some of us want to turn a blind eye to those who are doing just that program, and they've budgeted out through the year 2015. Now, we've had great relations at times, or common interests at times, with the Bolsheviks, with our humanitarian programs after the Russian Civil War, with Stalin during World War II. We even offered him the Marshall Plan aid, with Brezhnev and Andropov, with trade and arms control, and with Gorbachev supporting glasnost and perestroika. So even at our worst parts of relations with the Soviet Union, we still, which was actually communist Russia, we still had common relations. It didn't take away the fact that they did want to destroy us. But I think the danger now is that anti-government regime propaganda in Russia is so dominant, where they have shut down the free press, they have shut down all of the radio stations in Russia that broadcast Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, that's U.S. broadcasting, except three or four, so they've effectively silenced us. And then they're propagandizing their children that we are the enemy, that Stalin was not a bad guy, that Russia should not be held accountable for the crimes of the communist past. So what the regime is teaching its children today tells us a lot about where that regime may be headed. It doesn't need to head that way. What we need to do is call them on it, as we would call a friend or a neighbor or a wayward relative or somebody else, and try to stop them from taking this path that they've chosen to take.
Here's Edward Lucas once more with the final results from the audience poll.
After the debate, 47% of you were in favor of the motion, so a small rise, but 41% of you were against, which is a huge rise, and only 12% were undecided. So I declare the motion carried, but by a much smaller margin than at the beginning. So both sides have some laurels to rest on. So thanks very much.
And that concludes our debate. To hear the full unedited version of this or other debates in the IQ Squared series, or to subscribe to our podcast, visit npr.org/intelligencesquared. The Intelligence Squared U.S. Debate Series is an initiative of the Rosencrantz Foundation, Chairman Robert Rosencrantz, Executive Producer Dana Wolf. For more information about this series or to find out how you can get tickets to attend future live events, visit www.iq2us.org. That's www.iq2us.org. The goal of Intelligence Squared U.S. is to raise the level of public discourse in American life and to recognize that on most contentious issues, both sides have intellectually respectable views. This series is produced for radio by WNYC in New York. Producer Rob Christensen, senior producer Ellen Horn. The recording was engineered by Damon Whittemore and Edward Haber, with production assistance from Heather Radke. Intelligence Squared U.S. is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring Turtle Island Quartet on November 28th with special guest Leo Kottke. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
You're listening to AM 580 WILL Urbana. Thanks for joining us on this Thanksgiving holiday. The National Weather Service says we can expect a high in the upper 30s today with northwest wind 10 to 15.